In 1973, a young Canadian folk singer named Bruce Cockburn released an album called Night Vision. The artwork on the cover is a large black mare galloping down the middle of a train track, heading directly towards an oncoming locomotive. The horse has huge rippling muscles, its ears are back, and its hooves are up in full forward flight towards the train's headlight. The track cuts a clear line through long grass, and it looks like prairie, open and empty. But this is a transcontinental train barreling through the heart of the Tantramar Marsh. Horse and Train was painted by Alex Coville some 20 years earlier. In 1954, Coville was teaching at Mount Allison University in Sackville, which sits close to this marsh.
Sackville is a... unusual. I think it's not the kind of town that people think it is. It's small, it's not pretty, not, I would say, beautiful in any ordinary sense of the word.
Coville came here because he wanted to live outside the so-called art game. There were a few thousand people in the town and surrounding farms, and the air smelled of salt.
Sackville was a kind of nowhere. Kind of nowhere place, and there was something about that that he liked.
Lucy McDonald is a curator at the Owens Art Gallery at Mount Allison.
Well, I think that there is a certain openness in his work that reflects or perhaps sort of resonates with the marsh environment. And he did talk about the horizontal nature of the marshes as being something that attracted him. He described them as bleak, and he described this landscape as not particularly pretty or beautiful, but something that obviously had really incredible impact on him.
The Tantramar Marsh covers 20,000 hectares. It's one of the largest contiguous salt marshes on the Atlantic coast of North America. This is a crossroads, New Brunswick on one side, Nova Scotia on the other. And these marshes are part of the Isthmus of Chignecto, more or less the geographic center of the Maritimes. The name Chignecto comes from the Mi'kmaq name Siknik, or drainage place. Every 12 hours, the Bay of Fundy, with its world record high tides, brings in 160 billion tons of seawater, covering the mudflats and grasses. When it drains, these mudflats are an essential stop and feeding ground for geese and many birds, great blue heron, black duck, great horned owl, northern harrier, eider, the much-loved semi-palmated sandpiper. A vast ridged pasture sloping down red banks into a tidal river, this marsh was a portage route for the Mi'kmaq and later became home for the Europeans that settled here.
Yeah, it's always windy here. The hairdo in Sackville doesn't exist, or in the Tantramar Marshes for sure. If you live here, your hair is always messed up. That's what an old lady told me.
My name is André Charron, and I'm a city girl, believe it or not. I grew up in Cement in Montreal, but we moved in what we call anecdotally Acadia here, L'Acadie, when I was very young. So I spent a lot of time in this region, and I didn't know I was in love with this region until I left and I lived in another country. And then I came back and I realized I was living in a paradise.
André Charron is a retired environmental planner who spent her working life thinking about this land. The change that's happened here over the last few hundred years is so large that it's hard to see. But for Sackville to exist at all, for this train to have a track, or for the Trans-Canada Highway to have asphalt, or for some of these houses to stand here, the salt marsh had to be drained.
So we're walking on a country road or a tractor dirt road heading towards the Cumberland Basin. And we're looking at the dike right now in front of us, and tractors and hay and flowers and flat land, for sure. And this is what we are walking on here. It's called the dike lands. and it's unique to this area.
When the Acadians first came here, the noise of the flocks of shorebirds and the sound of the incoming tide was deafening. So they called this place Tantamar, which translates loosely as a great din. They hoped that the marsh would be a good place to farm. There weren't many rocks, but there was an astonishing flood of seawater every 12 hours. So they began to build seawalls, dikes, using wooden posts, earth, seagrasses, and branches to keep the Bay of Fundy out. And one Acadian farmer, whose name is long gone, left behind these words.
In the long marsh, the post lands, building gradually by actual hands against the basin tides. Hard hands, hard seas, hard wind lands, going where it led them to do it, to make hay meadows and gardens. I am here, finally, searching the bay, feeling out the nervous glittering of gulls.
The Mi'kmaq and the Acadians lived in harmony here, sharing the land, intermarrying, and they transformed much of the salt marsh into farmland for hay fields and grazing livestock. In 1755, the British invaded, and the marsh was the site of the first expulsion of the Acadians. Homes, barns, and churches were burned to the ground, and an estimated 10,000 were deported, a dark event in Acadian consciousness known as Le Grand Derangement, the Great Upheaval. Wake up, wake up. The goddams are on their way to burn down the harvest. Wake up, Acadian men, to protect the village. Farmland was offered to loyalists, and British settlers began arriving to farm the marsh. Among them, black loyalists who settled on the Nova Scotia side of the marsh. George Eliot Clark imagined the hard lives they led in this poem from his book Saltwater Spirituals and Deeper Blues.
Brown blown fall fields yield to spring sprung green garb with black thread train tracks all along the Tantramar marshes. We are at home inside this jacket of earth that time and the first sin have woven about us. We are at home under the tombstones and foundations of the Amherst African Methodist Episcopal Church, where worms work out a final solution to the problems of race.
By the mid-19th century, the marsh had become the largest hayfield in the world. Imported grass species now covered half the marsh. Hundreds of post and beam hay barns were erected. Tantramar hay was sold to stables and lumber camps all over Atlantic Canada and down to Boston. But nature has a way of leveling some of the best laid plans.
From the Halifax Citizen, October 9, 1869. At Sackville, the tide was 6 feet higher than ever before known, and 10 feet above the level of the marshes, which are covered with water as far as the eye can see. Thousands of tons have been destroyed. Whole barns and their contents have tossed for miles in some cases. The railway is completely torn up. Horses, oxen, sheep, and pigs have been drowned in great numbers and are lying amid rubbish of every conceivable kind, but the exact loss is unknown. There is scarcely a fence to be seen. All are swept away.
Despite the setback of the Saxby Gale, agriculture recovered here, but with industrialization, hay prices were starting to drop. During those years, the marshes may not have been turning big profits, but the unique landscape was starting to be recognized by poets. The bard of the Tantramar, Charles G.D. Roberts, grew up near the marsh. In Tantramar Revisited, written in 1883, he calls up the landscape of his youth.
Fenced on its seaward border with long clay dike shrieks from the turbid surge and flow of the tides vexing the Westmoreland shores. Miles on miles they extend, level and grassy and dim, clear from the long red sweep of flats to the sky in the distance.
A century later, American poet Elizabeth Bishop would get on a bus in Nova Scotia and document her journey into Tantramar and beyond in The Moose.
From narrow provinces of fish and bread and tea, home of the long tides where the bay leaves the sea, a pale flickering, gone, the Tantramar marshes and the smell of salt hay, an iron bridge trembles, and a loose plank rattles, but doesn't give way.
The marsh is still a magnetic landscape for writers. The poet Amanda Jernigan is sitting on a dilapidated homemade skateboard ramp for an unobstructed view of the marsh.
You know, this is a space that a lot of people pass through, right? The Isthmus of Chignecto, which connects these two land masses, now called New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, but middle of Mi'kmaqi, right? Traditional traveling route, and still a traveling route. So it's a place that people pass through all the time. But it's also a place that all these natural forces pass through all the time. Wind, water. I live out on the bay, and so I see those great big fundy tides come in and out, in and out, in and out. And here we're on the marsh, and I always feel the ocean here is kind of a ghost presence. You know, it's the banished sea, right, in these diked lands. But it still kind of comes up, rolls up on the land in the form of this wind that you can probably hear right now. Across the marsh, you came to me, as if the grasses were a sea, your voice had power not to calm, but to congeal. And I said, come. The water suffers you to pass, whose too, too solid flesh is grass.
Harry Thurston is a poet and nature writer who lives down the shore in Tignish, Nova Scotia, overlooking some of the only salt marsh in the Tantramar that isn't diked.
There's a rhythm to living in this place which fascinates me as a naturalist, and in some ways I suppose relates to my work as a poet too, which is patterned and rhythmed. Heron, still here, watching the watcher. Lift your wings, nimbus rising over the Atlantic, and the heart lifts too. You are the overseer of tall grasses, spartina and sedges, a tangle of driftwood, up and walking. Out for a stroll, you turn the marsh into murderer's row as you pluck one, then another, with appalling aplomb. To be that still, inert as mineral, to wait, stalwart, without weariness, staring down the barrel of your beak, eyes balanced like a pince-nez reading depth. Today there's probably 15% of the original salt marsh that's still intact. The rest of it has been diked and is now either used for agricultural land or as freshwater marsh. It no longer is open to the sea.
With climate change, sea levels are rising. Every year, the waters of the Bay of Fundy creep up another few millimeters. On the edge of Sackville, more than 30 kilometers of dikes are so far containing the tides, keeping them from flooding neighborhoods and businesses. But many of the dikes are badly in need of repair, and some of them are shored up with boulders.
I'm Jeff Hollerhead, and I'm a coastal geomorphologist, and right now we're in Woodpoint, New Brunswick. Just a little bit south of Sackville, New Brunswick. And we're standing on a dike right now, looking out at the Cumberland Basin, Bay of Fundy. We're at low tide. And particularly for the Bay of Fundy, that's important because it's hard to imagine the water coming over the dikes right now. You look at it and you say, but yeah, the water's like way out there and it's way down there. And it is. But with a 12 to 14 meter tidal range, if we were to wait a few hours, the water will be, you know, right up here to the base of the dike. And the problem that we're facing in this particular region is that when these dikes were built, they would have been back some distance from the edge. The problem has become is that the dikes are fixed. They don't move as the landscape changes.
Tantramar, the river deep and tidal, moving on a March morning, high as she goes. There in the bay.
Well, it's a land of two colors, light blue and green. And it's flat. It's the sky and the grass and the red mud too, let's not forget. So it's part of our life, the tide, the wind, and the red clay, the sediment. And when I talk to you right now, I've got goosebumps. It's sacred land. It's threatened at this time, these marshlands. We have more storm events now, and it's a very dynamic place, if anything, because we have played with nature.
With rising sea levels and eroded land and broken dikes, the towns and road and rail travel in the region are vulnerable. The governments of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia are well aware there could be trouble here. A $700,000 study is now looking at the feasibility of protecting this area as a transportation corridor.
But we have also on this isthmus, we have a train track that is the same height as the dike, about 10 meters. And we have also the highway. So those are belts that are connecting these two masses of land, these two hills, like I was saying, cutting through the dike land. Those are really a threat. And it would make Nova Scotia an island. If it continues to go, if they don't do anything, we will have a bridge to Nova Scotia. And this is in the short term. I'd say, hard to say, 10, 20 years it could happen.
Thaddeus Helonia spent decades photographing the changes on the marsh, bridges and hay barns that have slowly been reclaimed by nature. Of the 400 barns that were on the marsh, there's only 13 still standing.
I think the dike should just be allowed to go back to not existing, make it salt marsh again, you know, what it was originally.
It's surreal to cycle along a dirt road that the ocean wants to reclaim. The specter of this land being underwater has always been here.
You know, things that humans do to the marsh tend to be temporary or temporal. It's a come and a go kind of a thing.
However distant, flooding is a looming threat that produces its own kind of poetry. Douglas Lockheed walked on the Tantramar Marsh daily for years and has written hundreds of odes to the marsh.
A matter of time. It is only a matter of time given one high tide, and the land will shake loose, clearing out the silt century. And a low tide, there will be old adzes and saws of lost men who turned up regular and built ships for trading from this bay. It is all gone, but we'll come back in old logbooks, accounts of companies, in the sun's memory of slips, shouts, and ropes.
For the Sunday edition, I'm Jana Graham on the Tantramar Marsh in New Brunswick.